Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host Scott Parkin in Berkeley, California. And as always, I'm joined by Bob Bazanko in Niles, Ohio. And today we are going to be talking with Peter Byrne, who is an award-winning investigative science reporter, but has been working with Project Censored. And we just recently had Mickey Huff from Project Censored on the show. But Peter has been working on a new series of articles called Military AI Watch. And Peter is a national and international award-winning investigative science writer and has written in a whole big list of things that I'm not going to go into today. But I just want to say, Peter, welcome to the Green and Red podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah. And your new series with Project Censored is called Military AI Watch, which reveals the danger of developing artificial intelligence for military use. And it's going to be a 10-part series, and you've released three so far, with the newest one coming out just today, I believe. But maybe just give us an overview about this new series from Project Censored that you're working on with Project Censored.
Unlike most people that cover artificial intelligence, and they tend to stick to either just the tech or maybe sometimes just the finance, I do both. I combine examination and investigation of who's behind the development of these artificial intelligence-enabled weapons, and I also go into the tech. So my stories are pretty heavy. I believe they're readable to the ordinary person because that's who I'm writing for, but they don't shy away from describing the technologies that are at hand because most people really don't know anything about artificial intelligence. And I've been fortunate enough for the last couple of years to have been doing a really deep dive into both the tech of it and the financial aspects of it. As you can see, I have like crates full of information because I print everything out and I don't like to read on screens. And when it came to publishing it, I went to Project Censored because I've worked with them in the past. I have a great admiration for Mickey and Andy Lee Roth, who's editing this series, and I knew that they wouldn't censor me.
And how would you say that, just as an overview, how would you say that artificial intelligence is changing the military?
There's a couple of things going on. Silicon Valley is trumpeting going to war with China to destroy its industrial base for creating artificial intelligence because they find that China is competing with their products. And that warmongering is led by Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, who combined with the late war criminal Henry Kissinger, wrote a book called The Age of AI a couple of years ago, in which, echoing a lot of what's coming out of Silicon Valley, people like Mark Andreessen and Peter Thiel and Alex Carr, people like that, they're just whipping up this whole anti-Chinese war fever. And one of the reasons that they're doing it is because they know that China has a fairly advanced military and that China is definitely looking at artificial intelligence in terms of weaponizing it, and that's their gig, is weaponizing artificial intelligence. There's a lot of people, I think, in the military with actual experience of going to wars who don't like this at all, because the kind of wet dream that these Silicon Valley war dogs have is something called the Joint All Awareness Domain Command and Control System, or JADAC. And their dream is that they can have hundreds of thousands and actually millions of sensors throughout the globe, all streaming electrons and photons into a central data center, in a data center or a collection of data centers, in which they can have a kind of a picture on screen of the entire battle space, as they call it, and then they can control it. But of course, the amount of data that would be streaming in is so large and unfathomable that they want to use large language models to parse it and to make decisions in the absence of human thought, which is far too slow to deal with the kind of wars that they're envisioning. They're envisioning wars that take place at light speed and that happen in nanoseconds. They're flash wars. Now, this is a paradigm shift from the kind of warfare that Lockheed Martin and Boeing, Raytheon and Northrop Grumman and the other primes have been preparing for and fighting for many years. So they like aircraft carriers and intercontinental ballistic missiles. They like hardware. They like huge systems. And they basically, if you look at the spending of the United States government, Lockheed Martin gets more money than any collection of 25 countries in the world today, just from the United States government for making weapons. And when Silicon Valley came along, they worked to change the contracting procedures. They were complaining that it takes too long to get the Pentagon to look at a piece of weaponry that they, software-enabled weaponry, and then buy it. It can take several years for the Pentagon to vet a contract and promulgate it. And they call that the Valley of Death. They fear the Valley of Death. So Schmidt and Thiel and Andreessen and others have long been agitated. And these people are multi-billionaires and Musk is in there with huge amounts of influence on the United States government, obviously. They've been agitating for the Pentagon to use what are called other transaction authorities, which are basically workarounds where you don't have to spend much time investigating whether or not the weapon's going to work. You just buy it and allow the company to develop it. So Peter Thiel, who's the main character in the first article in my series, which is called One Ring to Rule Them All, is in a bit the Oz behind a lot of all this. The guy is extremely powerful, and I think the general public doesn't know that much about him. He is very anti-democratic. He believes that women shouldn't vote. He believes that he shouldn't have to pay taxes. He'd like to live on an offshore island that has its own kind of national standing, and he's joined in that by a lot of Silicon Valley oligarchs who call it the network society. They want network states, so-called. So Thiel, back in 2003, started a espionage firm called Palantir, which was named after the Seeing Stone in The Lord of the Rings, where the Dark Lord Sauron was able to look into this crystal and see where his enemies were and then go annihilate him with his orcs. You know. And he's got this thing about Tolkien, where he names most of his companies and investment arms after objects or characters in The Lord of the Rings. Is one of his capital investment firms is called Mithril Capital, for example. His little pawn, J.D. Vance, James David Vance, who has now high office in the United States, is a creation of Thiel. And Thiel funded Vance's venture capital firm, which is called Narya Capital, which is named after a white metal that appears in The Lord of the Rings. So they have this surrounded themselves with this kind of mythology, this Tolkien mythology, which actually turns reality upside down. Because if you look at Tolkien, it's interesting. He was writing in the 30s and 40s from the point of view of a upper middle class British academic who was terrified about what was going on in Russia with the Bolsheviks and the spread of communism throughout the world, China and Albania and elsewhere. And so really, the Dark Lord Sauron and the orcs are really the working class and the communists. And the brave middle-class hobbits go and they defeat them. And it's interesting that Thiel asks his workers to call themselves hobbits, but they're not really. They're really orcs. So the whole thing's turned upside down. And it's all about control. These people are utter control freaks, right? So part of being able to control is to know what people are doing. So Palantir started out with an investment from Thiel, who made his first few $100 million with PayPal, along with Elon Musk and other oligarchs that are still around. And he got his first investor was InQtel, which is the CIA's Silicon Valley investment arm. And immediately, Palantir was blessed with contracts from the CIA and the Department of Homeland Security, Border Control, now known as ICE, to build software that would sit on top of really huge databases that the government collects. The National Security Agency basically scoops up every communication in the world that it can lay its hands on. But nobody can parse this stuff in real time. So they just have these vast data centers full of information that they can go in and try to search and find connections and find people to harass and stuff like that. The Palantir software is very good at doing that. And they hired a lot of pretty smart people from Silicon Valley and Stanford and that whole kind of war industry that has permeated Silicon Valley forever, starting with Google, which was a creation of the military as much as anything else. Palantir was a private corporation until 2020, and not too much was known about it. Somebody leaked out their work that they were doing with the Los Angeles Police Department at one point, where they were doing predictive policing, which doesn't work, and except in terms of terrifying people. And it's like the film Total Recall, right? That's what Palantir is all about. But they also started contracting with foreign governments and foreign militaries and big multinationals like Coca-Cola. More than half of their contracts have always been with the governments and military and the intelligence agencies. In 2020, they went public, which meant that they had to start filing annual reports with the Securities and Exchange Commission, which actually are really interesting to read, because what one learns from that is that the way that the company is structured, Thiel is basically the mastermind. He's got all of the control through a special type of stock, along with his partner, Alexander Karp, who pretends or to be a progressive, quote unquote. Apparently he once took a class with Habermas and that qualifies him, but he's actually one of the most reactionary characters walking the planet. He recently wrote a book about technology that I talk about in the One Ring to Rule Them All, where he basically says, if other countries don't do what we say, we're going to destroy their leaders and kill their mistresses. And he's just a remarkably nasty, horrible person. And he's the front person for Palantir. Meanwhile, Thiel's more or less in the background calling the shots. And what they recently did, well, about 4 years ago, was they funded another startup called, after Palantir went public. Oh, let me digress back for a second. What was revealed by the SEC filings and the annual reports is they've never paid taxes. They run at huge deficits so they can declare a loss and not pay taxes. And then they go back to their investors to get more money to cover that so they can just keep rolling it over. However, I think last year they finally did declare a profit. It was like $450 million or something. And so the board of directors, which is just a kind of puppet board for Thiel, set aside several billion dollars to do stock buybacks, but only of the certain class of stock that was owned by the founders and the board of directors, which has various military and intelligence people on it, and even a former Wall Street Journal reporter. There's a lot of conflicts of interest involved with that. Anyway, they started up Anduril, which is the hardware side of things. Anduril, which is run by this nasty little piece of work called Palmer Luckey, who was on 60 Minutes a couple of weeks ago. 60 Minutes is just despicable. It is no longer like the Mike Wallace thing that we all grew up with, right? Where they actually did some real investigative reporting. It was a blowjob. They had this guy, Palmer Luckey, who's 33 years old, wearing a Hawaiian shirt and sandals. Isn't he cool? He makes these weapons of AI-dominated weapons that are going to kill all of our enemies and save American soldiers. And they just filleted him on international television. It was disgusting beyond belief. But at any rate, Anduril is the recipient, is still a private company, is still the recipient of billions and billions. I think it's worth like $200 billion now. Of contracts to make all sorts of advanced drones and surveillance devices that can call in machines from outer space that will use directed energy weapons to annihilate people that they don't like or facilities that they don't like.
And so are they doing this in the various conflict zones that we see? Are they doing this in Europe and the Ukraine-Russia conflict zone, or in the Middle East, or doing it along the U.S. southwest border?
Anduril and Palantir are deeply embedded in the Ukraine drone warfare.
which we can come back to a little bit later and how inefficacious that whole thing is. They're deeply both embedded in surveilling the border between the United States and Mexico with these towers that have AI algorithm-driven devices that do facial recognition on people that are crossing and then go and arrest their families who may be living in Los Angeles in order to better kidnap people. And they are definitely, along with Apple and Microsoft and the other giants, embedded in Gaza. The journal by the collection of Palestinian and Israeli reporters, 972, I think it was called, broke the story several months ago about Lavender and some other lovely names of AI programs that are calling in strikes on children and that are enabling second and third taps to go in to get the first responders and the people that go try to help people that have just been blown up. All these firms, led by Ellen Palantir's technologies, are deeply involved in the ongoing genocide in Gaza. And their weaponry is being purchased by other oppressive regimes throughout the world, Myanmar, and they'd like to sell weapons to anywhere there's conflict, India, Pakistan, you name it. You know, there are vultures that circle around blood.
Is the oppressive regime in which we live under, are we seeing this like where they're using it on domestic protest movements, social movements in the U.S.? I mean, I believe in the article you talk about, the Los Angeles Police Department uses it, but are we seeing it with the feds, Department of Homeland Security, that sort of thing?
A lot of the stuff is actually classified, but we do know about some of it. And Palantir has a license plate recognition device that's ubiquitous. And they have literally billions of dollars of contracts with the intelligence agencies and police departments, which I go into in some detail in the article, to do surveillance on people in the United States as well as elsewhere. I'm hearing a voice here somewhere.
Is it? Yeah. It's a background here. Sorry about that.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And one of the things I point out in the first article, One Ring to Rule Them All, which people can access at projectcensored.org, is that Anduril's been given several many billions of dollars worth of contracts under Small Business Administration guidelines. They're treating it as a minority-owned business, which it certainly is not. Not even by any stretch of the imagination. And when I asked the Pentagon about that, they said that they couldn't comment on it. But they literally, by being declared a small business, even though it's like a $200 billion company, they're able to bypass competitive bidding and other restrictions and get past that contractual valley of death that they all so much fear. There's a lot that can be explored from a judicial point of view. I'm very strongly make the case in the first article that this violates the antitrust laws of the United States, the Clayton Act and the famous laws that came into being after the muckraking era back around the turn of the 20th century when the Sherman Antitrust Act was enacted by Congress, because the great monopolists like John D. Rockefeller, who had not only oil but also railroads and banks, and J.P. Morgan and Jay Gould, the famous robber barons, they were just tanking the American economy constantly with crises, and families were dying of starvation because food monopolies were pricing things out too much for them to support themselves. And finally, it got to the point where Theodore Roosevelt, who was hardly like a socialist or a good guy, he was a rat, but it was the problem with the robber barons is they were making the American economy unsustainable for other elements in it, right? And so they went to pass these antitrust laws to curtail the octopus, as it were, the anti-competitive practices of Standard Oil and the railroad companies and J.P. Morgan's bank, which is still around under his name, because they would buy up their competitors, they would underprice their competitors and in the market and then buy them up and then increase the prices. So they broke up Standard Oil until Exxon and Texaco, other huge fossil fuel entities, which was not breaking it up too much, but it did lessen their hold on the economy and
promoted so-called free trade, because monopoly is antithetical, obviously, to free trade, whatever free trade is, in terms of how we think about the ability for corporations and companies to compete fairly against each other by the rules of capital. So Lina Khan, who was under Biden, was head of the Federal Trade Commission, wrote a really famous paper back in 2017 called The Amazon Paradox, which I talk about in the paper. And it compares Amazon to not only the Standard Oil, but to Microsoft, because the same thing was happening with Microsoft in the 1990s. It was getting so big, and it was such a huge spurning octopus with so many tentacles and so many businesses that it was killing competition. And the Department of Justice and 20 or so state attorney generals sued to break Microsoft up. And they didn't actually succeed in breaking it up, because that was the original court ruling that would have broken it up was overturned by an appeals court. But they did succeed in limiting its ability to buy up everything in sight that it wanted to buy. And I was told by the attorney at Electronic Frontier Foundation, who I quote in the article, that probably Microsoft would have strangled Google and Facebook in their cribs, which, all things considered, that would have been something salubrious. But the point was that Microsoft was curtailed, and it was curtailed before it had done some actions that were even more egregious than the ones that it had done. So Lina Khan was saying that this, it was the same thing with Amazon, that Amazon was becoming the Microsoft of its time and the Standard Oil of its time. And because it was so powerful in so many different aspects of the market, it was able to command prices that were killing competition. And that the thing about Amazon was that it needed to be curtailed more in the crib. It needed to have some boundaries put on it. So under Khan, over the past few years, there was a number of enforcement actions and lawsuits brought by the FTC against Apple and Meta and Google and other huge oligarchical Silicon Valley firms to curtail their lack of their anti-competitive activities, actually. And I think a lot of that's probably going south under Trump, but not all of it, because he doesn't like some of these Silicon Valley entities either. He wants to keep them under control and keep them fearful. But the point was that I started writing this first piece because it came to my attention that Anduril and Palantir were forming a consortium with several other startups to dominate the defense weapons, the AI weapons in particular, market through the Department of War, which is what we should more aptly call it. And this was obviously, in the face of it, anti-competitive and a violation of antitrust laws and statutes. So a lot of my article is trying, or actually does make, the case that in a system of government regulation, such as we supposedly have here in the best of times, now is the time to break up Anduril and Palantir, because they have cross-ownership. Their owners are engaged in anti-competitive activities, right, provably, and they're allowing them to keep expanding in unbridled, without restriction, is not only bad for the economy, it's a military disaster, because a lot of the weapon systems that are being promulgated by Silicon Valley in terms of trying to make this JADAC, this overall seeing stone, this command and control system that one guy can sit in the Pentagon and just go to and beat China in a battle, which is ridiculous, that these things don't work. All this artificial intelligence stuff now is based on large language models, which is like so overhyped and amazing. Large language models are not intelligent. They hallucinate, they confabulate, they lie all the time. And that can't be gotten rid of because of the way they're trained. They're trained on the internet. They're trained on Reddit and Common Crawl and Wikipedia. They're not trained on proprietary knowledge bases like what might be run by a physics department in a university or even by the military, because they send out these web scrapers to scrape up billions and billions of pieces of information and pixels in which to train their neural nets on. which I can get into in a second how that works, but it's internet garbage. It's garbage in, garbage out. It's just, we all know the internet's full of memes that are false and vitriol and lies and bias as much as it has anything that's also true and accurate. But the large language models can't distinguish between what may be a fact and what is a non-fact. There's a lot of science papers that come out that tend to be ignored by the media, but they're good science papers showing how fragile and how untrustworthy these large language models are. And increasingly, I think Fortune magazine just had an article about businesses are starting to shy away from them because they're finding that they're alienating people, that they're really not doing the kind of jobs that they're marketed to be doing. And so I think we're seeing a real bubble here. There's a just vast amount of money going into large language models and generative AI and artificial general intelligence, which is a chimera. It's kind of like tulip mania back in Holland in the 18th century. And it's expressed in one sense by my second article in this series, Military AI Watch, which is on data centers, by the overproliferation of data centers around the world. Everybody wants to build a data center. Stargate, the day after Trump was inaugurated, he calls Altman from OpenAI and Ellison from Oracle and Mr. Sun from SoftBank, the Japanese investment firm, into the Oval Office and says, you're going to put $500 billion into data centers so that we can have the most competitive AI programs in the world, which really means weapons. And the thing is that, first of all, data centers are massively polluting, just climate killing, electricity market killing, energy sucking behemoths that have nothing good to give us except more pain and suffering. And there's an over-proliferation of data centers in the world right now because everybody's trying to get into it. Trump and his family are co-invested with all these firms from Saudi Arabia and the Arab Emirates to go in and put billions of dollars into making data centers for OpenAI, not only in the Middle East, but also in Texas. But the problem is that these are, first, it's my firm belief, not just my firm belief, but the people that are really expert that I interviewed and I quote, that we're seeing a parabola here where the demand for generative AI is decreasing and localities are not willing to give over their entire electrical and energy infrastructures to Amazon Web Services, which is one of the biggest players in all of this. And so it's going to bust.
This is why we're seeing like Bill Gates invest in like nuclear, right? And we're having this, which I also think is a bubble and maybe a false promise, but there's a lot of conversation around like bringing back nuclear to power the data centers.
Yeah, because actually they talk about it, but the data centers that they are building are pretty much all fossil fuel based. And they talk about solar, but they're not doing much in that regard. So yeah, the wet dream of Gates and these other people is to bring back nuclear power. Of course, they always fail to address the elephant in the room, which is what do you do with the waste, right? And what do you do when it melts down? And we've seen this repeatedly in the history of nuclear power, which is why it has been waning. And they're trying to revitalize it because they want quick solutions. They need the power. And that's the problem. The generative AI and AI in general and the trajectory that it is taking technologically needs vast amounts of data, which it's running out of. It basically uses up the whole internet and it needs more and it can't get it. And vast amounts of power and vast numbers of advanced AI chips that cost $200,000 a piece. So the problem is, and the market's starting to realize it, is that where's the beef? What are you delivering here? Consumers aren't really doing very well. Consumers are attracted to it because it's almost like you pick up a rock and it starts talking to you by name and tells you like where you were born. Okay, big deal. It's like they've got this like deity thing going on with the chats, but that's wearing thin. The oligarchs are now making the case that, was it Zuckerberg a day or two said, most people only have two friends and the AIs can actually fill in the gap and give you more friends. But then there's always studies showing that it causes people to commit suicide because it's an empty relationship, blah, blah, blah. Obviously, there's nothing desirable from the human point of view to have a relationship with an electron. But they're grasping for uses for this technology. Now, unfortunately, probably the main focus that they have that they don't talk about is weapons. That's where they really want it to be used. They want it to be used to have autonomous weapons that can, this is, see, in my newest article, which is on the electromagnetic spectrum, AI battle space, I point out.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that.
That, and this is a fallacy that undermines the entire military aspect of this. All of these autonomous weapons rely on the ability to send and receive radio transmissions, the electromagnetic spectrum. And as we see in the Ukraine, the technology to jam that spectrum is even more powerful than the technology to create the autonomous weapons, because it's very easy to jam a $20 million weapon with radio waves or microwaves or any type of signal that can generate white noise and make it unable to decipher the signals coming from the global positioning satellites that it relies upon to know where to fly. So the jamming situation in the Ukraine has got like something like 10, both sides, Ukraine and Russia, are losing like 10,000 drones a month. They're mass producing millions and millions of drones because they're playing the law of large numbers, because they're also have these electronic jamming devices. Both sides have them. So probably 95 out of 100 drones doesn't get to where they would want it to be to release its explosives, because it falls out of the sky due to jamming, or it gets confused and it goes in the wrong direction. Now, unfortunately, 5% of them do get through, and that's where you see the damage. But if you look at the recent attack of Russia on occupied areas and cities in the Ukraine, yeah, a handful of explosions happened because a handful of drones got through. But they don't talk about the drones that didn't get through. But it's gotten so bad from that military point of view, if you want your drone to be a successful weapon, that now the drones are engineered to have these gossamer thin little fiber optic cables that come out of their butts as they fly. But they can't fly more than about 20 kilometers at the most. But because it's basically linked back to the computer operator that's flying it, by a fiber optic cable, you can't jam it with the electromagnetic spectrum. You can, however, shoot it down with a bullet, or you can send a drone that has a net to capture it. They do that a lot, stuff like that. But there's a kind of a stalemate, not just in the trench warfare in the Ukraine, but in the technological realm, where every time that somebody comes up with a counter drone measure, then the other side comes up with a counter drone measure, and it keeps going on. But the momentum's on the side of the jammers, because it's much easier and cheaper to do that. So Palantir and Anduril are in the thick of this, and this is where they're testing all their weapons. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, getting paid billions of dollars by the Ukrainians and, well, by the Americans, actually.
And this is also where we've seen the Houthi be able to, like, really counter this, like, mass attack that the U.S. launched on them a couple of months ago as well, which led to Trump signing an agreement with the Houthi, or a ceasefire with the Houthi.
Yeah, they had to, because they were losing like $1 billion a day by these do-it-yourself methods that the Houthis were arraying against them. There's plenty of little videos and stuff that you can find online. It's some good reports in military journals about the ingenuity of the Houthis. They basically are David against Goliath, and they succeeded in, they defeated the American Navy in the last couple of months and the American Air Force. They absorbed a number of hits, but one thing they learned how to do was to hide from satellites in their terrain, which is amenable to that. It's a little bit harder in the desert. And they also realized that they can use jammers. And you can have a jammer for a couple of $1,000s that will bring back down a $2 million missile. So the point, I think one of the major points that I'm making throughout this series is that, yeah, these weapons can cause a lot of pain and suffering, and they can achieve certain types of objectives, but for the most part, they're militarily ineffective. And it's gotten to the point, now I point out this in my latest one on electronic warfare on the AI battle space, RAND Corporation, which is the reactionary think tank that's been behind military strategizing throughout the entire Cold War, ever since World War II, has come out recently saying that the notion of centralizing the command and control is a disaster. It will never work. It's not working. and they're calling for decentralization. It's part of this whole military has been very cognizant of advances in chaos theory and complex adaptive system theory and network theory over the years. And they keep going back and forth between centralizing their command and control operations and decentralizing it. And now it's going towards the decentralizing, which is freaking out the Silicon Valley control freaks, because what they're selling is the perception that they can centralize everything and get away from. Palmer Luckey had made this absurd statement not too long ago that in the future, when two sides are preparing to go to war with each other, all they have to do is reveal their mutual technological capabilities. And then one side will say, oh, you're better than me. We'll give up. Here, you can take everything that you want. Take our raw materials, our population, everything else. And we won't fight you because we know that we can't beat your drones. That's not how war works. War is not a freaking game. And these people treat it like a game. I don't think that they have any empathy whatsoever for the victims of their weapons, but they live in this fantastic bubble in Silicon Valley and the Pentagon where they believe that they're going to somehow miraculously find the technology that allows them to dominate the entire world without putting themselves on the line, because those people aren't going to go into the front lines and risk their lives.
I'm going to go backward to something I was going to ask you at the outset. What are the military applications of AI? I know, you know, we're all familiar with, like, and I think we're familiar with warfare that involves spies and satellites, maybe tanks, armor, planes, actual people. How has that changed now in terms of collecting intelligence or determining positions, or what actually is AI doing in the military itself?
It's still nascent. It hasn't completely taken over. The chats are obviously the newest iteration of AI, but AI goes back to World War II. The bomb sites that were made to enable the B-17 bombers to more accurately drop bombs on German and Japanese cities were an early form of artificial intelligence that Norbert Wiener, who was like, he coined the word cybernetics, was involved in. We'll get back to him in a second. So over the last 70 years, it's been like five different kind of waves of various types of what were called artificial intelligence, right? They're just advances in computation. Computation has always been rule-based, where when you wrote programs, you program it. If C happens, then you do D, and if D happens, then you do F and Y. You know, the neural nets are a little bit different. They're predictive devices. What they're doing is they're examining incoming data and trying to match it up with data they've been trained on. And then they're seeing how close pieces of that data are to each other. For instance, with a picture of a cat, they break it up into the cat's toes and the cat's paw, the cat's leg, the cat's head. And if in this kind of what they call a phase space in these neural nets, which is known as a black box, well, you can't see what's going on in there. But the way it's structured is that the cat's paw is going to be closer to the cat's head than, say, a brick in terms of the probability of the two being connected. So what they're doing is they're constantly measuring probabilities and predicting correlations between objects or between words or what they call tokens, which are pieces of words or pieces of objects. They're predicting that these pieces are going to make a greater whole. And that's why they hallucinate and confabulate all the time, because they make mistakes. They can't help but do that because the data is, one, so immense, and two, so polluted with inaccuracies that they can't put it together. So the Anduril, for example, right now, is building this huge factory in Columbus, Ohio, next to an airport, to manufacture smart drones that will be enabled by AI. So the theory is that you can launch the drone and it won't have to connect to the satellite system because it would be jammed to do that. And swarms of them will be able to fly together and based on instructions that have been given to it by humans or maybe by an AI commander of some sort, it'll seek out targets, whether those targets happen to be some guy wearing a keffiyeh or some young woman carrying a bucket of water or a tank or whatever. And then they will be able to make these lethal decisions on their own in combat. So the pushback to this from some forces in Silicon Valley and civil society, killer robots and all that, has been really feeble. It basically says we have to have a human in the kill chain. Only humans can decide whether or not to pull the trigger and kill another human. That's ridiculous. When did the kill chain start? When you designed the robot, right? Or at the moment when the robot decides to do what you programmed it to do? The issue really is that we shouldn't have these types of weapons at all. But more than that, why is the United States not engaged in nuclear disarmament talks? Why is it not engaged in actually trying to foment peace in the world, but the opposite? Why did that cretin Biden give away his entire administration to Lockheed Martin? The inmates are in charge of the boat right now. These people that are running things, this ruling class here and abroad, are like, why does the scum rise to the top? We're being our societies are being run by people who have zero interest in life or the quality of life of the masses of people, and only an interest in their short-term profits. So what we're seeing here is Silicon Valley hucksters, because most of these guys aren't even programmers, like Schmidt and Musk and people like that. They're not scientists. They're hucksters, are trying to use their huge platforms and influence and money to convince people that, one, war is with China is imminent, so we have to be prepared to beat them. And two, if it's not China, it's going to be some terrorist somewhere. And three, if it's not some terrorist, it's going to be Russia or, God forbid, Mexico. So we just have to be prepared because we're surrounded by enemies. Actually, they're the enemy. What their goal is to insert AI into all of the military apparatus. And I don't think that's been done beyond the drones too much, although they're trying to get the nuclear command and control system to be on to have elements of generative AI put into it, which it may actually have. So the short story is we don't know exactly how much of the large language models, the chats, are being inserted into the weapons, but that's the goal. And it's not going to work. Provably, it's not going to work, and it's not working. So it's a recipe for disaster. And people that are in the military and in the think tank realm that have any sense of reality are realizing that and trying to pull back from it. And RAND is a case in point.
One question I have is, how competitive is AI in other parts of the world, in China, Russia, India, places that are like we see ourselves in competition with other larger powers?
It's like with nuclear weapons. Russia didn't make a rush for nuclear weapons after World War II until we did it. They did it because they knew that they were next. China invented its nuclear weapons in the 60s, and they've always had policy of keeping their warheads separate from the missiles. Unlike us, we have what's called launch on warning, which means that the warhead sits atop the missile, and we get 10 minutes warning that something's coming at us, or there's a computer glitch that looks like something's coming at us. And the president, and only the president, who's obviously going to be a really sane person, gets to push the button. And that's the end of the whole thing, because nuclear winter ensues after that. China, recently, intelligence shows, abandoned its previous policy of keeping the warhead separate from the missiles, which would have taken days for them to insert them so they couldn't react spontaneously to a threat and preemptorily. I think they changed it because of the obvious posturing of the United States, because the United States wants control of Taiwan. And why does it want control of Taiwan? Because Taiwan Semiconductor is there. It's the place where AI chips, most advanced AI chips, are made. They are not made anywhere else. They're designed in other places, but the OpenAI and the rest of the people, NVIDIA, that design the chips, they go to Taiwan to get them made. And so that's the thing. So that's what the point being, that in the same way that China and I think arguably Russia have largely beefed up their military applications out of fear that we were going to attack them, because that's what we do, the same thing's happening with AI. They weren't going down that road until we forced them to do it. All this rhetoric that comes out of Silicon Valley and of Washington, D.C., increasingly we have to go to war with China, or we're going to all be speaking Chinese. has forced the Chinese to increasingly use AI in their weapons systems. One thing that legislates against, and it's a good thing, I think, against the possibilities of us ending up in a horrible nuclear war out of all this, is the actual globalization of all these supply chains. Because it actually is impossible, even for China, just to act alone. China can't build the most advanced AI weapons because the machinery that makes the actual chips is based in the Netherlands, right? And their machinery in China isn't quite up to speed with the technological chops that the Dutch machinery has. And then you have to have rare minerals and metals mined from elsewhere in the world. China has a lot. We have a lot. There's different types that you can't get from one place to the other. So you really do have a very globalized supply chain for all the AI tech, and it takes thousands of moving parts. So it's difficult for an entity to just close off its borders and pretend that it's going to be able to dominate AI, which is the bullshit that Trump was putting out, basically. We're going to make all the data centers here. When they turned around and started like promoting the data centers that are being made in the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia because his kids are invested in them, right? There's no rhyme or reason in anything that Trump does except profit making for himself. It's just this huge organized crime that has taken over even more than usual. So I think the answer to the question that you were getting at is it's in process, and it's something that can be stopped if people are aware of it. If, for example, the Israelis would not be able to continue their genocide in Gaza if the Americans stopped funding it. Unfortunately, like something like 82% of Israelis think it's okay to have genocide, and probably like as many Americans think the same thing. But not everybody thinks like that. And the more people are aware of what's actually going on, then the more reason that they will have self-interest-wise to stop it. Because the problem with some of this command and control stuff is that, yeah, you have a little conventional war, but these conventional wars, as the war games have shown that I'm going to be writing about next month, consistently, when they're run by AIs with AI-enabled capabilities, always end up in a nuclear exchange because everybody gets backed into a corner. This shit doesn't work the way that they thought it was going to work, or their data centers get taken out by a hyperglide missile, and which means that they lose their picture, or their satellites get blown up by electromagnetic pulse by a nuclear weapon going off in outer space, which blinds them. So what do? They launch their nuclear weapons because that's how they think, and that's how they've been planning on. And for some reason, ever since Obama, or before that, ever since the fall of the Soviet Union, actually, the idea of having unilateral, multilateral nuclear arms control or any kind of arms control has just gone out the window. Because as far as I'm concerned, Lockheed runs this country.
We're getting near the end of our time. I have one other question, which is just as a, and we have to have you back on again because this is a lot and I'd like to talk more about it, particularly after you put out more articles. But just, can you give us a preview of what your next article, what the next couple of articles are going to be on? Because this is like some fascinating stuff. Like we really talked about some stuff that you see in the headlines, but we're been diving deep into what those headlines are.
Right. My first article, it was about Anduril and Palantir and antitrust. And then the second one was about the data centers and how World War III will actually be fought inside these data centers. Okay. Stargate fiasco, I called it. The one that just came out is on the electromagnetic spectrum, which I think is really super interesting. One of the things it does is it reveals how there's a conflict right now between the military in the United States and commerce, because commerce wants to dominate the 5G cell phone infrastructure in the United States, but the military doesn't want to let them because they own that infrastructure. So that's something that people need to know more about it. And then I'm going to talk in the next one. It comes out like the last Thursday of every month, so the next one will be in June, about the war games that have been being run using AI in war games by various think tanks and the military that always end up in nuclear war. And then I think I'm going to start talking about people like Eric Schmidt and Gilman Louie. Most people don't know who Gilman Louie is. He's one of the most influential people in the AI world and has been for 30 years. He's the guy that started InQtel that funded Peter Thiel's Palantir that I was talking about. And he and Schmidt and Musk and these other oligarchs, they all have these nonprofit foundations, which have billions and billions of dollars worth of stock in them. And they use them as stock manipulation devices. They give out a certain amount of money, which they can declare as tax write-offs, to civil society. They give out thousands and thousands of grants to media organizations, scientific organizations, religious organizations. And you know what happens when people give you, when somebody gives you money, is you don't criticize them, right? So they're essentially tacitly buying off vast realms of civil society and the media through their nonprofit foundations. So we're going to talk about that and space wars and all sorts of stuff. I'm supposed to do 10 of these once a month through next January, but I'll probably keep going on it because it's not going to stop anytime soon. And there's always new developments.
The OpenAI was in the headlines today about the UAE making a deal with them. It was in the New York Times today.
Yeah, you know what? OpenAI, I predict it won't even be here in a year. I think Microsoft is going to swallow it.
Yeah.
And I hope it does because those people are bad news.
Yeah, definitely. Peter Byrne, it's been great talking to you today. Folks, check out Military AI Watch, which is a project through Project Censored. We'll put the link in the show notes. Folks, if you like what you're hearing, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. If you're listening to this on a platform, give us a rate and review. And if you really like us, go to greenandredpodcast.org and hit that support button or become a patron at patreon.com/greenandredpodcast. Peter, it's been great talking with you today. And hopefully we'll catch up again with you soon as you move further along in the series.
Sure. I like to
talk to you later.